realm of Hollywood. As it turned out, I didn't sign on to the show as a professional dancer until 2011, for season 13, at age 25, the same age that Max was when he started. I had nothing but the deepest love for my older brother. He means more to me than I can express. When anyone refers to me as Max Smrkovsky's kid brother, wow, I feel a surge of happiness and respect. But again, that small inside voice kicks in. Hey, I want to call out, I'm not anyone's kid brother. Well, I am, but that's not all I am. I'm not some sidekick, and I never set out to be Robin. I am Batman. And yet my first soundbite on my first season as a pro, the first time the audience encountered me as a member of the cast, set the snarky, stammering tone. I'm Valentin Smrkovsky. No, wait. I'm Val Smrkovsky. And it took my brother 12 seasons to try to win this thing. He still hasn't done so, so I'm here to redeem the family name. It's probably one of the most obnoxious things I've ever said. And I've said a lot of obnoxious things in my life. As a green-ass grass rookie, I was not aware that sarcasm didn't play well on TV. The show wanted soundbites, punchlines, and catchphrases, so I went ahead and made my first impression on the show, coming off like a snotty little douchebag. Max's fans jumped all over my trash talk. What they were reacting to was banter, nothing more, just playful sarcasm. The simple fact that there was now a pair of brothers dancing as professionals seemed to challenge some people. A tiny fraction of the commentators were off-the-hook fanatical, and they were extremely active in the show's forums and on the other social media, posting comments daily. They were not always the nicest comments, either, and at times, straight into bullshit slander and totally whack opinions. A few of the online posters came off as rancid little trolls, man, more interested in tearing other contestants down than building their candidate up. It was a losing proposition, but there were times when I could not resist baiting them back. Oh, hey, yo, I would post tempting to give the crazies a little reality check. I'm standing right here with your main man, your hero, and we're laughing at you together at how truly insane and extreme your comments are. Unfair and silly as it was, the fan base broke down into rival camps, the true blue Americans versus the foreign immigrants, and I'll let you guess who led the list of the outsiders. The Russians were coming, the dark and deadly Smrkovsky clan. The show will turn into Dancing with the Czars. My celebrity partner that debut season, Elisabetta Canales, had a career in Italy as an actress, spokeswoman, and model. Elisabetta was a beautiful person, stunningly pretty, spoke English with a sweet and sultry Italian accent. She had long served as a muse for fashion designer Roberto Cavalli, but in 2011, she was most well known for going through a very public breakup with superstar actor George Clooney. Talk about being labeled. None of Elisabetta's credits, nothing about her sophisticated, statuesque European aura mattered. Because all people saw when they looked at her was Clooney's ex. A season on Dancing with the Stars was actually an excellent way for celebrities to push the reset button. Athletes, actors, singers, and media personalities could come on the show and simply display sides of themselves that the public never saw. The producers participated in the same stereotyping as the rest of the country, but the smartest celebrity contestants found a way around that, playing ball to some extent, while at the same time not taking their public images too seriously. A sense of playfulness was required. Elisabetta found herself with an awesome opportunity to slip out from underneath the ex-girlfriend label and present herself as herself. Unfortunately for her, she drew me as a professional partner. I walked into the first meeting with my celebrity partner to find the drop-dead beautiful Italian woman. Elisabetta Canales obviously didn't know me from a hole in the wall, and I came to understand that she had never really even watched the show before committing to appear. And I repeat, Elisabetta signed up for Dancing with the Stars without having ever watched the show. It was the blind leading the blind. I had zero experience as a Dancing with the Stars professional partner. My brother's advice and opinions could guide me, but for better or worse, I was determined to make my own choices. Even so, I always felt Max's presence as if he was looking over my shoulder at everything I did. There were four people in the rehearsal room. Two flesh and blood, humans, me and Elisabetta, and two ghosts, Max and George. Feeling the need to prove myself, I shifted immediately into alpha mode. I was coming in totally energized, not arrogant. I mean, I was grateful to be there, but maybe a little bit too cocky. I carried my experience in the competitive dance world as a badge of honor. I might not have spoken my attitude in words, but to the other professional dancers, it must have come through loud and clear. Look, you little fuckers, haven't been on a real dance floor in years. I'm an athlete. Insert chest thump. At the peak of my physique. And another. I can dance 10 dances in a row and not break a sweat. Y'all probably can't even do two routines without wheezing and puking. I was ready to teach whoever I got as a partner how to become a world champion ballroom dancer, while in front of me stood a woman who had no idea what she was getting into. Elisabetta was certainly cool, smart, and pleasant enough, but as far as she was concerned, we could have been doing nunchucks with the stars. "I'm excited to learn how to dance," she said, in a cool European tone that indicated Elisabetta never got excited about much of anything. People got excited about her, not the other way around. We were at completely different stages in our lives. She was shell-shocked after being dragged through the media muck for a few months, and I was this peppy little upstart puppy nipping at her heels. We started working together, and yes, she was without a doubt an awesome chick, but dancing was hard for her. In fact, dancing was really, really hard for Elisabetta Canales. I'll take the blame, all right? My style of teaching wasn't making the process easier. I should have told myself that with only 3 weeks to teach her how to dance, I had to accept how vulnerable she was and acknowledge what she could and couldn't do. I had no patience for insecurity and was so driven to succeed that I overplayed my role a bit. I still had the competition perspective in my blood. I thought I was back teaching at Rising Stars Dance Academy, where tough love was the order of the day and no coddling was allowed. I went into the rehearsal period full steam, and my attitude caught Elisabetta off guard. So about a week and a half in, we had a little moment. She and I, caught on camera, pretty much summing up the state of our relationship. We were rehearsing the quick step, a fast dance that was really difficult to learn and even harder to get right. I mean, it's called the quick step, right? So I think the difficulty should be pretty self-explanatory right from the start. Elisabetta might have noticed that my fashion sense was way off. I dressed like the 60-year-old ballroom dance teacher I had worked with 2 years before in London. Shout out to Alan Fletcher. Elisabetta's fashion guru, Roberto Cavalli, would have shuddered and hid his eyes. "Quick, quick, slow," I called out. We were already halfway through the rehearsal process. Dancing wasn't getting any easier for her, and my tone wasn't getting any brighter. I wasn't gloomy, and I never belittled anybody. But at that point in time, I didn't place as much value on uplifting rhetoric, because I was so accustomed to using challenging rhetoric. I thought that if I pushed my student, they would know that I cared, because I was challenging to surpass their own expectations. The people in the world that I came from, the world of dance sport, knew never to take it personally. But George Clooney had never talked to Elisabetta like I was talking to her. Nobody in their right mind would dare to talk to this woman the way I was. She was a big star in Italy, where people walked on eggshells around her, the way they behaved toward A-list celebrities in the States. "Quick, quick, slow. Quick, quick, slow." "Hey, hey," she muttered, rolling her big, beautiful runway model eyes at me. She didn't understand what I was doing, and didn't feel it either. At that point, she didn't even want to feel it. Instead of trying to make her understand, I should have focused on an easier dance step that would maybe help her enjoy dance in general. At least that would have represented progress for her, after which she might have gradually come to understand what we were trying to do. I spun around, demonstrating. "Quick, quick, slow. Quick, quick, slow." "I still don't understand," she wailed. "Quick, quick, slow. Quick, quick, slow. Quick, show me again," she ordered, cutting me off. "Show it to me again." Those were her words, but when I heard them in my head, it was something different. "Dance, monkey, dance." I had an image of me as a Blackpool champion standing there in front of a woman who's what? George Clooney's ex? Someone who'd had a bit of a part in Deuce Bigelow, European Gigolo? I turned to her and I said, you know I'm not your bitch, right? Whoa, double whoa. She rolled her eyes and said, what? She was appalled. What did you say? I'm out here trying to make you look good, I said, trying to justify myself. I'm here for you. Not for me, she responded. Then she started gathering up her things, all the while muttering curse words in street slang Italian. The camera caught it all, and even though the producers wound up not using my not your bitch line, viewers got the idea. Obviously, we made up after that day and let bygones be bygones. But the damage had been done. Our rehearsal package aired in week two, and not too coincidentally, we got eliminated from the show that week. Like I said, I'll take the blame. I wasn't good at communicating within what was a new environment for me. I had a lot of learning to do. But actually, that early elimination might have been the best thing that ever happened to me on Dancing with the Stars. It not only ended the agony, but it meant producers could assign me to perform as a solo dancer on featured pro numbers. I was able to demonstrate what I was actually good at, which at that point was dancing. What I wasn't good at, not yet at least, was guiding a celebrity partner. I busted my ass showing what I could do. I was already looking ahead to the next season and knew I had to find a way to stand out. On the basis of my miserable showing with Elisabetta, I wasn't sure that I would be asked back. So I pulled out all the stops as a dancer. Some of the pros allow their feelings to get hurt when they were eliminated. Their egos kicked in and they would turn their backs on the remaining episodes of the show. They didn't want to perform in the pre-commercial bumper. They didn't want to do the 30-second filler, and they didn't want to do a performance for a visiting guest artist. I had a different attitude. Yo, I just left my whole world to be on the show. Give me as much camera time as possible. Unlucky Season 13 of Dancing with the Stars features celebrity contestants such as Ricky Lake, Rob Kardashian, and J.R. Martinez, who won with an overwhelming number of viewer votes. Chaz Bono's appearance triggered protests from conservatives because he was transgender. NBA forward Meta World Peace, whose real name was Ron Artest, partnered with my brother's future wife, Peter Murgatroyd, who was taking her first turn as a pro dancer. But Meta and Peter were the first couple to be eliminated, thankfully for me. Season 13 also featured a week 6 exchange between my brother and the judges for which I might have been at least partly to blame. I remember he and I stood together watching the couple going on before him, and it bothered us both when their routine received extravagant praise from the judges, totally overblown for what Max and I considered was at best a mediocre performance. So he vented to me a little about the cluelessness of the judges. Bitching about the adjudicators was a time-honored ballroom tradition, so I joined in on the trash talk. Instead of calming him down, I acted as a catalyst for his outrage, getting him even more hyped up than he was to begin with. He went out, did his number with his partner, Hope Solo, the famously fiery goalkeeper from the U.S. women's soccer team. It was Broadway week on Dancing with the Stars, so they performed the rumba to Seasons of Love from the Broadway show Rent. When Judge Len Goodman came down hard on Solo, "This was your worst dance of the season, in my opinion," Max reacted. Waving his arms over his head, he encouraged the crowd to boo Goodman's comments, which they did enthusiastically. "Don't start all that, Max, because half the fault is yours," Goodman said. "Well, as long as the audience likes our journey, right?" "Let me tell you, Max, the audience likes the effect. They judge on efficacy. I've been in this business for over 50 years. Max, under his breath, said, "Maybe it's time to get out." Judge Carrie Ann and Abba spanked Max for his diss of Goodman. Have some respect. So there was plenty of leftover tension when the host, Brooke Burke, did the post-routine interview. She asked my brother how he felt about the scoring. He voiced his disappointment, then added a comment heard around the Dancing with the Stars world. "With all due respect," he said, "this is my show." All microphones should come with a warning sign. Use of this device by Maxim Trinkovsky could result in injury or death. He was notorious for his "that wasn't disgusting" style of off-the-cuff comments. I knew exactly what he was trying to say. that the dancers were responsible for the show right alongside the hosts, judges, and producers. It was indeed Max's show, as much as anyone else's. But that's not what America heard. Viewers misconstrued the comment as a typical Max the Knife arrogance. The discussion boards and commentary threads lit up. No one wanted to cut this well-meaning English as a second language dancer a break. Maybe he couldn't express himself perfectly, but his heart was always in the right place, right? In protecting Hope, he was only expressing his loyalty to a teammate. It wasn't much, but within the closed system of Dancing with the Stars, the whole business qualified as a major dust-up. I felt bad, because I had fired my brother up, and he said things he probably wouldn't have said otherwise. We were like kids on a playground. You act a little differently, and talk a little trashier when you have your boy backing you up. During my debut season, I experienced the backstage chatter at Dancing with the Stars for the first time. I knew a lot of the professional dancers, so I wasn't a total outsider. Not much that was being said surprised me, since the talk was the familiar routine about aches and pains, the opinions of judges, and who was an item and who wasn't. I thought I was back in the sweaty changing rooms of the competition circuit, or in the cafeteria at a high school. The environment may be different, but people were the same all over. I did get introduced to something that was new to me, an ongoing discussion about the Dancing with the Stars pros. Not a debate, really, more like a sore topic that everyone kept revisiting. The question centered on who had it easier, the female professionals who were teaching male celebrities or the male dancers like me, who taught female partners. That there was any question on the subject took me by surprise. To me, the answer was ragingly obvious. Of course, the male pros have a bigger challenge, simply due to the nature of ballroom dancing. In the pure, original, authentic tradition of ballroom, the dynamic between male and female partners was extremely well-defined. The woman was the work of art, while the man served as the frame for that work of art. The man's job was to present his partner in the most ideal manner possible. The female carried the heaviest load and was the focus of the spotlight. The role of the male in the ballroom dance world, the authentic ballroom world, was to complete her in every way. The woman had much more work to do, much more business to attend to, than the man ever would. There's the famous line about the difference. Ginger Rogers did everything that Fred Astaire did, but backward and in high heels. I would be the first to tell you it was a lot easier to learn how to be a male ballroom dancer than it was to be an effective female ballroom dancer. I didn't think anyone could seriously deny that, but I got plenty of pushback from women pros on the show. See, with the celebrity contestants, they said, the assumption was that a man couldn't dance and that a female could. Plus, men were clumsier than women. Men were awkward, and men were harder to teach because their egos got in the way. I could see the women's point, but I wasn't buying their argument. Look, I could furnish a simple example of the double standard in ballroom. A male celebrity dancer could spend 4/8 of a bar of cha-cha-cha music, a bar being 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. Just unbuttoning his shirt, then spending another half bar taking his shirt off. I've done it myself. Afterward, he could throw in a pelvic thrust and maybe, depending on the song, whip that shirt around his head and throw it in the audience, ending up with a New Yorker pose with an arm raised high. The judges would score the male dancer's routine, the audience would love it, and people watching at home would praise the energy and excitement with comments such as, "Oh my God, that was my uncle's move at the wedding." Meanwhile, what was the female of the couple up to? She couldn't just stand there and watch the male take 4/8 of a bar stripping his shirt off. I knew I could never leave my partner stationary, have her stand there smiling like a mannequin while I rode around her, do 2 spins myself, hold on to her, and then do a dip while she does her New Yorker. For a female to do what a male did simply wouldn't make sense. In authentic ballroom, the woman dancer is always absorbed in movement. She has much more to do than the man. Girl pros on the show did incredible moves by themselves and finished by themselves, only to have the male celebrity next to them strike a pose and shout, "Yeah!" Camera zoomed in for the guy's triumphant moment. take the same choreography and reverse the gender, and we would have the male celebrity flying around doing crazy spins, stopping and hitting the line with the female pro doing the yeah moment. The whole essence of ballroom dancing, as opposed to, say, solo tap or jazz, is that men and women dance together. They create movement together. We are creating with each other. Who has it easier? The question reminds me of Zeus and Hera in Greek mythology debating over who took more pleasure from sex, males or females. Zeus said women did, while Hera said men. Luckily, they had someone who could settle the question with authority. The prophet Tiresias had spent some years as a male, and then other years as a female. Don't ask me to explain how, even though I do live in West Hollywood. And he answered that it was women who had the better time of it. Did that end the debate? No. The conversation continued, just like ours did, about whether male or female pros had the harder time on the show. I had my own opinion, but no one was interested in the new guy on the show putting in his 2 cents. So I just kept it moving and agreed to disagree. As the season progressed, I realized I had 2 jobs, dancing well on the show and slipping out from the shadow of my big brother. During the period when he was toiling away season after season on Dancing with the Stars, and I was killing it on the competition circuit, our dynamics had shifted, and I wasn't sure Max was aware of that fact. I had become a different person from the one he had known so well before, and he had changed too. The years he had been in Los Angeles had affected us deeply. While I was concentrated on competing, our lives took separate tracks, his on the West Coast, mine on the East. We saw each other often, but not as much as we used to. In his absence, I stepped up to be the man of the household whenever my dad was away. I had the impossible job of trying to fill my brother's shoes coaching kids at Rising Stars. Now, signing on to Dancing with the Stars and entering into what had been Max's exclusive arena, I didn't want to give up my newfound independence. I couldn't change the fact that Max had been introduced to the show long before me. I couldn't help the audience members saw him first. I had to demonstrate to them that appreciation was not a zero-sum game, that people could appreciate me for being me, while still leaving enough space in their hearts to appreciate him for being him. My brother and I had to coexist and not lose our individuality, which took a lot of effort for a long, long time. By the time I joined Dancing with the Stars, Max had become jaded. He was more or less over it. He was a veteran of 11 seasons. Never once did Max not give his all in a performance for the show. But I detected some of the old Russian gloom beneath the surface, a bitterness and tension. Something was bothering him. Perhaps his agitation was warranted, but I didn't see addressing it as my battle. From the beginning, I filtered his advice on how to survive on the show, separated the good from the bad. There was good, productive advice that I could use, unproductive advice that I couldn't use, and there was also productive advice that I chose not to use. Ultimately, as much as you learn, as much information as you take in, and as much influence as you allow to shape you, you're the decision maker. I'm the decider, as President George W. Bush said. Owning your decisions is the only way you fully insulate yourself from regret. When you allow someone else to make your decisions for you, that's when things can go south in a hurry. Max had a different attitude toward the show, one that I didn't want to adopt just yet. I needed to go through my own growing pains, my own honeymoon period, and my own fed-up, disappointed period too. I had to find my own gray clouds and my own silver linings. I didn't need him to hold my hand the way he had done in Odessa, in Brooklyn, and beyond. They say you become an adult the instant you forgive your parents for whatever wrongs you imagine they've done to you. There was nothing for me to forgive with Max, but I still had to fight my way out from his shadow. I don't know if people realize how addictive the spotlight is, especially when you work so hard for it. Then it's the sweetest piece of cake you've ever tasted. The more you have to divide that piece, the harder it gets to share, and you find yourself wanting the whole thing. Being forced to split it with 11 other diva dancers creates a lot of intrigue and tension. Sharing the spotlight with a sibling has its own tricky challenges, working out to be great and awkward at the same time. On Dancing with the Stars, everybody was a star. Hollywood itself was a town of big fish coming out of small ponds, and a few of the biggest fish gobbled up all the attention. But I was determined to get my head on straight, forget about my past success on the competition circuit, and consciously become the humblest pro dancer that had ever appeared on the show. I had bombed out with Elisabetta, so I had nowhere to go but up. To get there, first I had to get myself invited back for the next season. Steps. Dancing with the Stars has spring and fall seasons every year, and the period of time in between them is called the mid-season. What people may not realize is that none of the professional dancers are guaranteed a spot on the show. The producers like to keep us in suspense until the very last minute. We find out we've been picked up only the day before we have to pack our bags and head back to work. In defense of the producers, they are simply real people wrestling with the monumental task of coming up with the perfect mix of dancers for a $1 million show. I came to see such last-minute dramatics not as an example of the cruelty of the world, necessarily, but simply as an indication of how show business worked. All the dancers signed a deal that gave the show priority in their lives, but it didn't work the other way around. The professionals weren't necessarily the main priority for the producers. Ratings were. Us dancers were cogs in a machine run by the higher-ups. I didn't hate the players, even though I might have disliked the way the game was played. I tried to keep my mind off the drama of whether I'd be re-signed and spent the mid-season going about my business. At that point, I wasn't reaping the fruits of my labor. I had stopped competing and came onto the show only to receive a slap-in-the-face reality check. After that first season, I returned to New York down, but not defeated. I told myself that even a faltering move forward is still a step in the right direction. I discovered my situation at home had changed a little. I couldn't necessarily go back to my work at Dance With Me Studios and do it anonymously as I had in the past. Without realizing it, I had become something like a D-list. No, not even D-list. I had become a G-list celebrity. I wasn't a B, a C, a D, an E, or even an F. I was stuck further down the alphabet. To my surprise, I found that even G-list celebrity status translated pretty well in the suburbs. In America, television made things real. I now had a wider audience appeal than I had ever enjoyed before. And when I did a seminar at our Dance With Me studio in Fort Lee, New Jersey, for example, I'd attract not just the school regulars, but also now some outside fans who wanted to stop in for a sniff. G-List was A-List in Fort Lee. All the talk about the big payoff for joining a hit TV show was great, but it wasn't the money that was inspiring me. I'd been broke for years before that and had always been happy as hell. I was after something else in Hollywood. I never wanted to be a little G-List bitch for anybody. That just wasn't my style. I came off the competition circuit as an alpha individual who had gained not just notoriety, but respect. I wanted the same result from Dancing with the Stars. I wanted respect. And then a development came along that crystallized everything, allowing me a crucial bit of insight into myself. That mid-season in 2013, at an event held in an Irish pub on Long Island, I was introduced to the concept of the meet and greet. The bar had dark wooden paneling and smelled of sweat and beer. I showed up to find a crowd of people who really wanted to hang out with me. I was astounded. G-list or not, I was able to attract a group of strangers willing to pay money to stand in line, have a picture taken, and engage in a 5-second conversation. I was about to turn 26, and that first humble meet and greet represented a holy fuck moment for me. At first, it came off like every other meet and greet in the world, with the fans herded along one by one. Step up, take a picture with me, move out. In, photo, out. The arrangement felt impersonal, so I turned to the organizers. "These people have dedicated their time to coming out here," I said, stating the obvious. "Yeah?" one of the handlers asked, not getting my point. "Keep it going." "Forget what they paid for this, that's on them," I said. "What about their time?" The expression on the face of the organizers said it all. What about it? Step up, take a photo, move out. The fans were giving up moments of their life to stand and wait for an opportunity to speak to me, to meet me. I wasn't going to give them a fake hug, a frozen smile, and send them off from my perch in the land of not giving a fuck. Faced with actual flesh and blood, human beings, I found that I couldn't treat them as mere units. How many units did you do today? Oh, I did 200 units. At 50 bucks a unit, that's... I just couldn't behave that way. Right there and then, I felt myself changing, starting to care about people more, now that I saw them caring about me. Some of their concern might be shallow. That's the dude on TV. I want to get a shot with him. But others showed a deep appreciation. They could cite chapter and verse of what I had done on the show. Bro, the number you did, the, you know, the quick step to the Pretenders, you know, don't get me wrong, that made my day, man, made my evening. I went to bed that night dreaming about dancing. Hey, my mom and I had a couple of years watching the show together and, you know, it brought us a lot closer together. My grandma passed away a month ago and your season was the last thing we shared. I always remember that, you know, that cha-cha you did to Katy Perry. We loved that. Connection. That was what was happening in that smelly pub on Long Island. And I came to realize that connection was what I'd been searching for my entire life. Suddenly I understood what I was really doing on Dancing with the Stars. I had been given this opportunity to have an impact on people simply by virtue of A, doing what I love, but also B, just by showing a little bit of care. The agents and meet and greet organizers failed to understand that connection took time. They wanted the usual process of stepping up, taking the photo, moving out. They looked at me with pity in their eyes as if I wasn't grasping an essential truth about my place in the world. For me, the process was different. Step up, connect, take a picture, say thanks and goodbye with a smile. We're both human beings, I thought, just to find the process to myself. This was one area where my usual motto of keep it moving didn't apply. The ratio of effort to happiness seemed to be mathematically magical. I was a superhero with a superpower where I could affect so many people in such a positive way. It was the best thing ever. From that point on, Dancing with the Stars took on a different meaning for me. I still wanted the glitz, the glamour, and the status. Yeah, I mean, I was still a performer. But now I understood the incredible power of connecting to people. I had always believed I had to act in, you know, keeping with my moral compass. I was raised that way, and it was still as if I was representing my parents with my actions. But I never really cared about strangers before, or what strangers' perception of me might be. In that moment, my attitude changed completely. Ah, so this was what I had been doing that first season on primetime television. It wasn't about hauling down a big payday, though that was nice, or beating out my fellow competitors, or as in my case that season, not beating them out. I was in the business of connecting with people. All of which made me desperately want to get re-signed for a second season, because that would allow me the opportunity to embark upon a similar trajectory with hundreds of thousands of new people. It didn't matter who the audience member was or what their situation in life might be. The exchange worked both ways, inspiring and being inspired. It was always possible that I could inspire somebody else, and that fact inspired me to stay inspired myself. Now that's a lot of inspiration. There were three tiers of producers in charge of Dancing with the Stars. First, there were my employers, the production company that worked with me, the in-the-studio, boots-on-the-ground team. They were hired by BBC Worldwide, the folks who held the rights to the program's original concept, first used by a popular show in the UK called Strictly Come Dancing. The BBC execs had the power to say, hey, we like this guy, and we don't like this guy. They, in turn, had been contracted by the show's distributor, ABC, and execs of the network could also weigh in. We don't like this girl, but we really like this girl. The production company, the BBC, and ABC. That was a lot of people I had to answer to. Me, who had never had to answer to anyone but my father before. I could not possibly question his love, and though his discipline was hard, I knew his intention was to give me the best shot at success. So this was a new situation, interestingly different, and really terrifying at the same time. All told, there were maybe 40 people who were making the ultimate decision on my life, and I didn't even know a lot of their names. Never looked them in the eyes, we never even shook hands. Given my less than stellar showing in my first season, the thread I was hanging from was probably a lot thinner than most of the other pros. But maybe the producers heard about what was going on those meet and greets during the mid-season breaks. Perhaps the people I met with and greeted had been inspired to post positive stuff about me on the show's discussion boards. Or the harsh reality could have been that I was still simply riding on Max's coattails. Whatever the reason, the thread didn't snap. I found myself on the receiving end of a Hollywood phone call inviting me to join Dancing with the Stars for the upcoming spring season. It felt like a reprieve, as though I had dodged a bullet. My season 14 partner was Sherry Shepherd, who at the time was a host on The View. Super smart, super bubbly, she was a comedian in her 40s who had just had a kid and was a woman who had been through a lot in her life. I always think the funnier the comedian is, the darker her journey to that laughter must have been. And this turned out to be the case with Sherry. Her strength came through in her personality, which had a lightness to it, yet at the same time, a gritty drive. She had a generous energy despite her past experiences, from poverty in Chicago, homelessness in LA. She made the arduous climb up comedy's ladder in little clubs around the country. And for her to wind up where she was represented a huge accomplishment. Now she had a beautiful son as well. Sherry rose super early every morning and took her place alongside ABC powerhouse Barbara Walters and one of my all-time favorites, Whoopi Goldberg. She had her hands full with The View and being a new mom, and she was so much in love with Dancing with the Stars that competing on the show had been her longtime dream. Every year she requested time off from The View, and every time she was told no. It didn't seem to matter that ABC broadcast both programs. Finally, in time for season 14, Barbara changed her tune. "Fine, Sherry, you can do it," she said. And I'm paraphrasing the conversation, by the way, I got secondhand from Sherry. "We're going to arrange for you to be in LA on Monday and Tuesday, and on those days you'll be on The View via satellite. Then you'll take the Red Eye Wednesday to be on the show in person Wednesday and Thursday, and for Friday's taped show." "Got it? Okay." A mid-40s new mother flying back and forth across the country for weeks. But Sherry's passion for Dancing with the Stars made it happen. It was her dream come true. I had a private thought of, fuck, what a responsibility. I didn't want to be the one who shattered the dream. How could I not want to give this woman an awesome chance to grow? I wanted her to be the star, because she deserved it. I wanted her to win. She kept to her regular schedule on The View during our three-week rehearsal period, which I loved because we were in New York City, not in West Hollywood or in some kind of windowless soundstage bunker somewhere in the valley. I was working two blocks from Lincoln Center with a dream gig in my dream city. I could be a human being with some resemblance to a normal life. I could have dinner with my parents, act responsibly with my friends, or hang out with a local artist over a big lunch in the village, and at the same time still be part of an incredible television phenomenon. The best of both worlds. Even though I wasn't exactly a pro at being a pro quite yet, we had a great season, and I was able to give Sherry a lot more than I had given Elisabetta. I discovered the skill of patience, which could work wonders with a partner new to the ballroom world, and which was a revelation for me at the time. I kicked myself for being such a little Hitler with Elisabetta, and resolved to be more forgiving this time around. Sherry wound up with a collection of amazing appearances to treasure, a string of killer routines as well as smaller moments of serene reflection. She was a memorable contestant on Dancing with the Stars, which was no small feat amid the dozen upon dozens of contestants spread over 25 seasons, some of whom were not memorable at all. We were eliminated after week 4, so again, I wasn't able to bring my partner to the halfway point in the show. But by that time, Sherry was exhausted and ready to leave. I idly formulated a half-assed conspiracy theory speculating that Barbara Walters had a hand in what happened. She got fed up with Sherry flying back and forth with half her heart on the dance floor in West Hollywood and the other set of a talk show in New York City. Barbara was powerful enough in the network hierarchy to get the word to the judges. Sherry Shepherd must be eliminated. "You did a little dancing," I imagined Barbara telling her co-host, "but you're finished out there." Whether this was my imagination or not, I couldn't blame Barbara a bit if she had been thinking that way at all. Sherry was an essential element on The View. When there were awkward moments between the other hosts, between Barbara and Whoopi Goldberg, say, it would always be Sherry's voice sounding a comical dun-da-dun-dun-dun that cut the tension and made everything okay. She contributed at least one great punchline every time she was on Dancing with the Stars. She might not have been the best dancer, but she was the highlight of each episode she was in, just due to her effervescent personality. On the level of pure entertainment, on the level of lasting inspiration, she was awesome. Peter Murgatroyd won that season as a pro dancer with her celebrity partner, Green Bay Packers wide receiver Donald Driver. She and I had both joined the show the season before. When she was eliminated first, I was eliminated second. Now I was eliminated fourth with Sherry, and Peter won the whole damn thing, taking home the Mirror Bowl trophy with Donald. I love Peter, and I was happy for her, but my inner competitor took a cold-eyed view of the situation. Well, Peter's moving at a faster pace than me, I couldn't help telling myself. That means I'm probably doing something wrong. I needed to evaluate what I could do differently in the next season, but I wasn't totally sure how to make that adjustment. By some secret calculus of public taste, after that second season, I moved up from being a G-list celebrity to taking my place on the F-list. I managed to get invited to The View and shake hands with Barbara Walters, which made me feel a little bit full of myself. I took a picture with Whoopi Goldberg. I mean, come on. Whoopi Goldberg. I was moving on up. At the same time, I was still the same old Val, the local kid, teaching lessons and holding seminars at Dance With Me Studios in New York. I was the same dude that students had sessions with for $60 an hour a year ago. I was on a TV show, but nothing had changed apart from that. Who cared about Hollywood? Doing the hard work on the dance floor was where all my credibility had come from. I wouldn't have been able to preach what I did if I didn't have follow-through in the studio. It wasn't any kind of miracle, and I wasn't there exactly doing God's work. I was doing Val's work. But I wanted to help people feel good and help them sense their innate self-worth. Heavily involved in Dance With Me Studios and hitting every meet and greet I possibly could, I nevertheless kept my ear to the ground for word from West Hollywood. Through the grapevine, I heard that the next season, season 15, would be an all-star affair, bringing back champions and fan favorites from the show's entire run. Okay, I thought, I'm out of a job. I had been on for only two seasons at that point, and neither of them had achieved any all-star result by any stretch of the imagination. It seemed I would never make it past eighth place. I was simply doing the math, being not pessimistic but rather realistic about my prospects of getting called back for this special season. My life hung in suspension. But finally the call came. First some British guy came on the line and screamed, "Hello, hello, hello," several times. Then he handed the call over to the American producers, Joe and Ashley. "Hey, how are you?" Ashley said. "We're very excited because you're back on." "Oh, wow. Thank you so much." "No, thank you so much," Joe chimed in. "We're excited about your partner." Next, the celebrity cast got announced, headlined by popular champions Emmett Smith and Drew Lachey. Then there was Apollo Ono, who was, you know, Apollo fucking Ono, wearer of the sickest soul patch, possessor of possibly the coolest name ever, and winner of 8 Olympic medals. Gilles Marini, probably one of the best celebrity male dancers the show had ever seen, came back for a second turn. Peter got paired up with him, making her the clear front runner among the pros. Actress Kirstie Alley was again matched with my brother Max, forming the same couple who were runners-up on the show's highest-rated season. Victim number 3 for me would ultimately be the one who helped me turn a corner on the show. My partner, Kelly Monaco, had won the Mirror Bowl 6 years before in the first season when Dancing with the Stars was just a six-couple, six-week show. She represented probably my last best chance. If I didn't prove myself this time around, paired with a former champion, how could the showrunners possibly justify bringing me back again? Kelly and I vibed right away. She was a chick from Philly, and I was a boy from Brooklyn, so we had growing up in the hood stories to share. Hanging together meant a blast of this big city East Coast nostalgia for her. I was 26, Kelly was 36, and had been through a lot of experiences in her life. On my part, I was happy AF teaching Rumble Walks to a former Playboy playmate. She had broken out at age 21 as a centerfold and worked her way into a starring role in a long-running ABC soap, General Hospital. During the years after her first Dancing with the Stars season in 2005, she had become increasingly connected with A-list Hollywood, a world that was totally beyond my scope. She knew everyone in town and had all the heaviest hitters on her speed dial. She was also an extraordinary beauty, and as a dance couple, we looked perfect together. When we interacted during our rehearsal spots, we displayed a great sense of banter, indulgent in smart-mouthed urban patter. We simply had good chemistry, the kind that translated perfectly onto the TV screen. That season was the first time that I felt the fans marked me for a big dose of romantic melodrama. Viewers played out my intimate relationship with Kelly, which took me somewhat by surprise. Maybe it was naive of me, but I never could understand why people are so obsessed with other people's chemistry. Getting swept up in the tempest of gossip, as I did with Kelly, I found the fixation was a little over the top, not to mention annoying. Interviewers and columnists wanted to know everything. But when you got something really special, you're not going to talk about it publicly 24/7. You're too busy living it. The curious public pried into every corner, marking everything we had together like a dog marks its territory. And yes, I just drew a comparison between gossip and a dog pissing on a tree. I didn't want the negative energy of other people's opinions to infiltrate my life. I never read tabloids or checked into the gossip shows on TV, but just knowing that they were talking about us became an intrusive influence. Whether Kelly and I were an item wasn't why I wanted to be the focus of conversations around the office water cooler. I wanted my efforts, my accomplishments, my moments of impact to be the center of attention, not what I did or did not do off the set. This is where you might look at me and say, "Really, Val? Hollywood is obsessed with romance? Really? You're so damn smart, but you didn't know that." Yeah, I'll own up to it. For all my experience, I was naive. I didn't know that people in general, and in Hollywood in particular, had become absurdly fixated upon other people's relationships, to the point where it sometimes seemed as though it was the only fucking thing in existence. I'd gaze longingly out of my bedroom window and wish upon a star. Oh, gee, I wish people were this concerned with a single-payer healthcare option. Yes, well, not really, but you get the idea. With Kelly, I experienced for the first time being the focal point of the public eye. As a couple, Elisabetta Canales and I had been non-starters. Even though we had great chemistry, Sherry Shepherd and I didn't exactly look like we were messing around. Fooling around, maybe joking like crazy, yes, but not hopping into bed together. I can't completely play ignorance over the situation because to some degree I participated in it. There was a reason for that. I had gone 2 episodes and out with Elisabetta, 4 and out with Sherry. Honestly, I was down for whatever would earn me another week to produce an awesome dance number for Kelly, even if it meant taping a package crammed full of cheeky innuendos and romantic nuance, and even though it meant being unable to watch a package without cringing at least once, even now. It wasn't as if what Kelly and I had together was some kind of artificial charade. I was young and single, she was amazing, and we had a natural attraction for each other. But I was never a person who kissed and told, and I was raised to keep personal lives private, with flamboyant PDAs considered low class. So the season might have been cringeworthy at times, but at least I did get a lot of airtime, and the internet went crazy with Kelly and Val. For the first time, I had a full adult season. The producers promoted me as the new sex symbol on the show. It worked because Kelly was so feminine and confident that She was a model for every woman. When a woman looks happy, fulfilled, empowered, and strong, the man standing next to her suddenly becomes a sex symbol. Yes, we played into it, okay. By week 10, Kelly and I were just laughing at the whole melodrama, honestly. Since I was already committed, I pushed my chips into the center of the table and went all in. During a wet, wild, and skimpy flamenco routine, Kelly flung off her top like a challenge, stripping down to a feathered bikini. As if in response, I ripped off my pants and went near commando in a black Speedo. Then we climbed into a platform with a pool of inch-deep water and danced and splashed around in that for a while. Off the hook, out of control, but way, way popular. The audience went nuts. For a quick minute, Speedo Flamenco became a thing. I had pushed the trademark Schmirkovsky move of taking my shirt off to a whole new level. Well, that happened, I tweeted afterward, hashtag sorry mom. The routine was a testament to our relationship, how I made Kelly feel, how I was able to present her to the world. On the discussion boards, the comments came fast and furious. Damn, so it's real, not just made for TV, and he's not just the little brother anymore. I started enjoying a bigger presence on the show, a bigger voice, and made it farther and farther into the season, all the way to the finals. But romance for ratings represented a deal with the devil, one that would come back to haunt me on future seasons. My partner, Kelly Monaco, mentored me in ways that I desperately needed back then. I didn't have that many friends who were truly entertainment industry insiders, and I lucked out with Kelly. My brother had a very different kind of relationship with Hollywood, and a different relationship with the show. So while much of his counsel helped me out, some definitely did not work for me. Kelly knew the town backward and forward. She was friends with people who had made it to a very high level, and now she was in love with a person who had just pulled himself up from G-list status and clawed himself way up onto the F-list. She was able to give me invaluable insight on how the wacky world of Hollywood worked. To cite just one example, I had always struggled at press events, especially the sort of round robins with multiple reporters that were commonplace in entertainment. I would get upset over questions that seemed shallow and absolutely brain dead, centered on some kind of nothing issue that I didn't care about. In my mind, I pictured myself as a talk show hero on Larry King Live or Real Time with Bill Maher. Deep into meaningful and incisive political exchanges. I'd be ready for complex discussions. The journalists would toss me softball questions after softball questions, and I always wound up feeling as though my intelligence had been insulted. Kelly set me straight. The key in all situations, Val, is always to know your audience, she told me. An example of the kind of memorable advice that's helped me forever afterward. It's not about what you know or what you want to say, she said to me. It's about doing all of those things at the right time for the right audience. There's a time to preach about changing the world and a time to just lightheartedly discuss your cha-cha. If you know that the audience was there for a specific reason, in other words, speak to your audience and speak to that reason. Don't just blurt out opinions and don't just share or overshare your weighty thoughts with everyone equally. Know your audience. A good rule of thumb in show business, and since the entire world is a stage, a good idea in life as a whole too. Reflecting on the events of my childhood, I realized that I had understood the concept from the very first, even if I was too young to put it into words. One way or another, I had always been playing to the audience. To explain better what I mean, let me go back to the beginning. Not to my start on Dancing with the Stars, but back to the real beginning. In a decayed Soviet harbor town known as the Pearl of the Black Sea. Part 2. A Journey in Life. Family. The most important thing to know about me is family. In fact, very nearly the only thing to know about me is family. Ours was a household of two sons and two parents. And as a team, we worked together better than the 1998 championship Chicago Bulls, better than a NASA astronaut crew, better than any other family I know. We were like a circus act, the flying Schmirkovskys and sons. At the head of the clan stood my father, Alexander Shmerkovsky, nicknamed Sasha, and my mother, Larissa Shmerkovskaya. My older brother, Max, beat me into existence by 6 years, 76 days, and a few spare change hours and minutes. He might have had a head start, but I've been catching up ever since. Whenever I spoke as a kid, everything tended to come out in terms of we. We have a dance school. I might have won a dance competition, but it was really we. We. I was afraid people couldn't understand that. I began to censor myself because it sounded as though I was using the royal we, the obnoxious, high-handed, regal style of speaking, as in British Queens, we are not amused. But for a long time, my reality was limited to a core gang of four. Me, my brother, my mom, and my pops. My whole life was we. Only recently, as I grew out of my 20s and into my 30s, have I felt any degree of separation from the family unit. Not much, but some. When I was growing up, my parents were always nearby, always with me, and my whole world was right there in front of my nose. Courtesy of my mom's cooking, the Shmerkovsky family was a movable feast. It didn't really matter where we'd park our gypsy caravan, whether living in Ukraine or experiencing life as immigrants in New York City, I'd always be chilling with the fam. We could be chilling in Antarctica, and we'd still be together. Odessa, Ukraine was where my father was born and grew up, where he met and married my mother, and where my parents raised Max and me. Moms and pops had what could be jokingly described as a mixed marriage. My mother's parents were both Eastern Orthodox and raised their daughter in that religion, while my father's people were Jewish. The truth was, our household was secular, and everyone was too caught up keeping hearth and home together to attend church or temple service. I grew up in a communist country where the weight of history was almost crushing. My paternal grandmother watched as her entire family was executed by the Nazis. Then she raised her children, my father included, in Soviet Ukraine, an atheist environment where the official party line portrayed religion as the poison of humanity. Comrade citizens could be sent to prison for any overt display of a religious symbol, whether it was a cross or a Star of David. My family's roots might have reached deep into Judaism and Christianity, but that background had to be kept buried, out of sight, when my father was young. When my father was 23, he lost his own father, whom he adored, who was his hero, who represented the only person on earth for whom he had any sort of filial love. He died 3 years before I was born, and so I was named after him, my paternal grandfather, Valentin Shmerkovsky. Even my mother spoke about him with reverence. "This was the greatest man," she would say with a faraway look in her eyes. "I married your father because I was in love with your grandfather." Throughout my childhood, I was always more intimate with my mom, but more influenced by my dad. Just as my dad's father was his hero, my father was mine. Honestly, even today I have a hard time with people telling me, "When I was growing up, Michael Jackson was my idol." Or LeBron James, Fred Astaire, or Steve Jobs, or whoever else they say, anyone in the world. "Really?" I think. "Did you have a father growing up?" How can your idol be anybody besides your father? I have to check myself because not everybody has been fortunate enough to have the type of father that I had, or to benefit from the kind of relationship that I enjoyed with my parents. In Russian, there's a phrase that translates to "hands of gold" in English. And as applied to my grandfather, it meant that everything he put his mind to turned out to be a great success. His passing was a blow that my dad never really recovered from. An emotional and spiritual blow, yes, definitely, but also a financial one. From that moment on, my father had to make his way on his own. We were Russians in Ukraine. We spoke the Russian language at home, and I think that a little of the philosophical Russian sadness invaded all our souls. The citizens of Eastern Europe were well known for their brand of weary cynicism, and there were many Russian phrases that foretell the future as a disaster waiting to happen. Doomsday was always just around the corner. In the unlikely event that anything positive occurred, the standard response was to say, "tfu tfu tfu," spit over the shoulder and knock on wood 3 times just so as not to jinx it. I don't think of it as superstition as much as paranoia. Every silver cloud had a gray lining, and a slight sense of pessimism afflicted us all. My dad's answer to his father's untimely death was to step into a phone booth and come back out as Superman. He did what everyone else in Ukraine was doing. which was to hustle relentlessly for the smallest scrap of advantage, the most minuscule amount of gain, but he did it in a supercharged way. When you're just scraping by, life very quickly becomes a Darwinian game of survival of the fittest.